Welcome to the Life Sciences Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Armando Cuesta, and today we're going to be diving into the world of AI and medicine. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Gustavo Stolvitzky, a thought leader in the realm of computational biology. Gustavo has been a pioneer in the realm of precision medicine. He was the director of IBM Translational Systems Biology and Nanobiotechnology Program, an adjunct professor at both the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and Columbia University, and is currently the chief scientific officer for Sema4, a precision medicine company. Gustavo has been a huge advocate in the world of crowdsourcing science, and he co-founded the Dream Challenges, an international collaborative effort to work towards solving problems in the world of computational biology. Gustavo's work has been integral in creating and implementing much of the algorithmic frameworks in precision medicine today, and it was a pleasure getting to speak with him about the problems he is working on today. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. And now, without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Gustavo Stolvitzky. So, computational biology is a field at the intersection of data science, biology, and a whole slew of other areas. And more recently, the introduction of artificial intelligence into the mix has really ramped up the progress of the growing field of precision medicine. Given your expertise and career in the world of AI and medicine, can you take us through a bit of the origins, history, and in your mind, the precipitating catalyst for the use of AI in medicine and how this synergy has enabled the creation of precision medicine?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. It's one that probably students of computational biology or even of medicine today maybe take it for granted, but it wasn't like this always. And the question that you're asking is very interesting. What precipitated all this explosion that will trigger the future, you know, way in which we will experience medicine? Probably the first step in this history is AI itself, right? Is how we started to think about artificial intelligence as opposed to natural intelligence, which is the intelligence that animals and humans have. It all started in the 50s when Alan Turing was thinking of how can you make machines think a little bit like humans, right? But in a time in which computers were completely underpowered, they were not even able to store the program that they were using in order to compute, right? But jump forward a few years, 1956, there was a famous, very famous conference in Dartmouth called the Dartmouth Summer Research Project on Artificial Intelligence, where people who were really intellectuals ahead of their time started to think a real program in which they gathered Claude Shannon and Marvin Minsky and, all the great philosophers, mathematicians, and budding computer scientists. That conference didn't yield what they had hoped to yield in 6 and 8 weeks. You cannot solve such a problem. But they laid out a path forward that is the one that we are living in. Basically, they wanted to create what today we would call artificial general intelligence. Actually, the name artificial intelligence was coined in that conference. Mm-hmm. And then go forward a few years and you start to see the progress that today we start to recognize artificial intelligence, which was, a machine that could play checkers and eventually, do very well at checkers. And going forward, Deep Blue that eventually beat Garry Kasparov, and more recently, DeepMind creating the AlphaGo that beat the champions in Go. And that is kind of just only one thread of the very deep and rich artificial intelligence history. One of the catalyzers that made it explode is probably the conjunction of new algorithms, in particular one type of algorithm that is called deep learning, and the possibility of doing a lot of computing very fast, right? I remember when we were in the early 2000s, I was in IBM. We were thinking, what is the next computer architecture that will allow us to have petaflops? That means 10 to the 15 is 1, followed by 15 zeros, a lot, 1,000 trillion floating point operations per second. And today we have 1,000 times more. They are building computers at the exaflop level. So that's one arc, artificial intelligence. Computers, I would say, the ability to run fast some algorithms that solve some interesting problems in terms of decision-making, rule-based, logical thinking, and rapid processing of information is what makes artificial intelligence what it is. And parallel to it, in the year 1990, scientists started to think, why don't we sequence the human genome? And that came at the time in which biotechnology has started to become important as a source of intellectual discoveries, but also as a source of industry launching ideas. And it was clear that the Sanger sequencing that was prevalent in those days could do something, but it was too slow, too costly. And so they started to think of ways in which they could sequence the genome, which, by the way, many people thought it was crazy. Many people think, I don't want to know anything about this because it's going to fail. But the mere idea of trying to do that allowed people to think of new ways of sequencing that created a lot of data that needed to be organized in ways. This is information that needed to be organized in such a way that it's like Humpty Dumpty. You break the whole genome, what is called a shotgun sequencing, and then you reassemble it. And in order to do that, you have to do a lot of algorithmic improvements and innovation, which eventually happened, as well as new ways of sequencing, new technology that allowed sequencing fast, going into a number of companies that enabled that, and so on. Fast forward a few years, and in 2003, it was announced that the human genome was sequenced. Now you have identified the 3 billion nucleotides that form the blueprint of our being, biological being, right? Jump now a few years, new ways of sequencing appeared. That's another arc, right? Technology and the incredible curiosity of humankind to go where our curiosity brings us, in this case, sequencing the human genome. The crossroads there is, how do we assemble the genomes that we created by breaking apart the human genome and then, you know, putting it together? So algorithmic ways that use some of the things that the artificial intelligence pioneers starting to envision, though it's not a general purpose machine that this was creating that thinks anything and then solves like a human would do. It's more, let's see how we solve a specific problem, which comes to be a narrow AI. That means you solve one problem. It's not that like us humans or animals that presented with a variety of problems, we are able to think of all of those and address them. These are, you know, computer programs that solve one problem. That's why it's narrow AI. Now, what was the catalyzer for precision medicine? That started to happen when we started to see the emergence of what is called the DNA chip microarrays, in which we were looking at technology that allowed us to estimate the level of expression of each gene, what we call the DNA chips sometimes. Because the DNA tells us what the cell could do, but not what the cell is doing. What tells us what the cell is doing is the transcriptomics, that means the messages that the DNA code for, and the proteomics. So it's really the activity and the dynamics of this DNA once it unfolds into information. At that moment, there was a huge optimism in the what now it was called computational biology field that started in the mid-1990s, early 2000s. Before that, you will be hard-pressed to find any academic department that calls themselves Department of Computational Biology or Department of Systems Biology. It simply didn't exist. As much as before 1950, there was no computer science department, right? So now we can talk about computational aspects of biological information or computational biology. The DNA chips allowed us to estimate what the cell was doing, and so people started to go like crazy with great optimism to understand what cells were doing at different tissues, in different diseases, and so on. DNA arrays then paved the way to what we call today precision medicine in the following way, that people started to feel the optimism that we could, and maybe it was a very, we could call it over-optimism in a way, because we thought DNA arrays could do a lot more than they really could do. Not because it's bad technology, it's because biology is always surprising us with more complexity, right? And so, but DNA microarrays allowed us to do molecular classification of disease, and that required a lot of computation, a lot of algorithmic ways of thinking, a lot of assembling the system in ways, the system being the cell in the context of a tissue, the tissue in the context of an organ, the organ in the context of an organism. And that came to be called that system of systems, systems biology. And now coming back to answer your question, finally after a long loop. Now, the notion of precision medicine emerges as a way to think, well, this is a very complex system. Human beings or animal biology or biology, you know, and even if it is plant biology, is complex. This is a system of systems. We need to understand how it works. When it comes to disease, the understanding of how it works almost at an individual level, or at least at the group of individuals, meaning subsets of the population that have the same type of characteristics of disease, then people started to think maybe with these tools that we have, now the DNA arrays morphed into what is called RNA sequencing, which is a better way of seeing what we are sequencing, or targeted proteomics or plethora really of technologies that allows us to see what's happening. And the question then was, can we be more precise in treating patients that is not based on the average patient, but is based on the characteristic that we are discovering based on the specific molecular understanding, and sometimes not just molecular, but the global understanding of the information that the patient has that includes family history, that is genetics, lifestyle, and environmental exposures. So that's the arc, I would say. Artificial intelligence merges in trying to understand biological complexity and the data that emerges from technology, and that corresponds to the field of computational biology that leverages mathematics, engineering, artificial intelligence in the hopes of harnessing the complexity of biology in order to be a tool for medicine.
That was a very comprehensive and well-rounded explanation. And going back to your point, I agree that the Human Genome Project was critical for the field's development. This was an incredible endeavor that lasts for over a decade and brought together all these algorithms and concepts that originated in the 50s and the 60s. And another very interesting idea that you mentioned is this term that a lot of people bring up when discussing AI as a whole, and that's the idea of deep learning. And sometimes it's used maybe in an imprecise way. And you mentioned that it was also a catalyzer for the industry. And I was wondering, in what sense you think the discovery of this type of algorithm, deep learning, was a breakthrough for precision medicine?
I think it's becoming more and more clear that deep learning solves problems that other algorithms in the global world of narrow artificial intelligence cannot solve. Maybe we should make a little detour. I like to open as many parentheses as I can close, right? So the tour has to do with what we call artificial intelligence. Actually, is the forefathers of artificial intelligence thought of something very concrete. But in time, the term was used in order to explain different ways in which we can analyze data in order to understand hidden patterns in the data, right? And it gave rise to something that for some time was called machine learning, or continues to be called machine learning, which is kind of a downgrade of the big hopes of the forefathers of artificial intelligence, who were thinking, we want to make algorithms and machines that think like humans. Huge, ambitious project. Still, people continue to think in terms of artificial general intelligence. This is the way of a general purpose solver of problems that you don't even know exist. You only discover when you live. This is the way we learn as humans. Now, that artificial intelligence programming was so ambitious, continues to be, is creating the robots that we see in the science fiction movies, or systems that can solve things by thinking and creating their own programs and creating their own strategies and plans. That is not the artificial intelligence that we are using in computational biology, by and large. What we are using is what is called machine learning, or signal processing, or different kinds of engineering on physics-based models that are trying to go to the heart of the mechanism, like physics understands how the planets go around the sun, not by algorithmic ways, but by fundamental principles that were proposed first by Newton and then by Einstein, the mechanistic way of understanding it. That's what where we are trying to go for biology as well. But it's so complex, as we said before, that sometimes you have to settle for less. And so if you can find hidden patterns that are not probably the fundamental principles, but are close to it enough that allows you to make predictions or to know what is going to come next, given the current situations. For example, if I have current DNA of a person with cancer and the DNA of the cancer and the transcriptomic of the cancer, the prediction would be what therapy is the best for this type of patients. That's the precision medicine question. Or what is the prognosis of this patient? Should I consider an aggressive course of therapy, or maybe don't do anything because it's going to be an indolent disease going forward? So those predictions are what we are trying to do using machine learning, mechanistic models, a la physics, and signal processing, and all that we have at hand. So all that is what today we call, if you will, artificial intelligence. So it's a big of a stretch. Within those algorithms, there is a subset of algorithms that started in the 70s coming from neuroscience, which is your field, right? It's trying to understand how the brain works. And some people say the brain is the most complex system in the universe. So I have seen that said over and over, with 86 billion neurons and the complexities of the dynamics of these neurons and so on. They try to harness that complexity in the 70s with very simple models of how these neurons work. And they call them artificial neural networks, which is basically, imagine that we have a number of neurons at the entry where we feed the data in, and then these neurons go to other set of neurons. It's a hidden layer, as they call, maybe two or three hidden layers in the 70s, they were thinking. Then to an output layer that is basically what determines what is at the input. For example, if I put an image of an animal, is it a cat, is it a hippopotamus or what, right? And so at the output, it tells me something about the input that somehow wasn't obvious. Now, I said artificial neural networks and layers, what is called multi-layer perceptrons. In the early 2000s, the number of these layers started to go from 2, 3, which is what computers allowed you to do, to 10, 20, 100 in different architectures that would allow for solving different problems that is at the input. And so that is what we call deep learning. And it turns out to be a powerful tool to analyze images, to analyze language, to analyze signals in time, like electrocardiograms, electroencephalograms. So give it data enough to train it, as you would train a kid in school. You would give many, many examples of things that you want to learn. For example, problems in mathematics, take the square root, or, solve differential equations in a higher math. You give 1,000 of those and you make mistakes. You learn, your professor tells you this is right, this is wrong. That's what the input will be. Many things that maybe contain what you want. Let me give you a concrete example. For example, a mammogram that may have the signature of cancer. The output, this deep learner will tell you has cancer or doesn't have cancer. When it says it doesn't have cancer, but it does, then the algorithm will try to understand why did it say has cancer when it doesn't. And vice versa, when it doesn't have cancer, but it says it does, then which would be what we call a false positive, the previous one was a false negative, then you would try to teach it. So you give hundreds of thousands of examples, what is called supervised learning, and the output will tell you eventually whether the image will have cancer or not, the mammogram, the x-ray, and then there you are, a deep learner that will tell you something of importance for the health of a woman as to whether she has or doesn't have cancer. And that is one of the active areas of research for deep learning, for example. So deep learning does very well with images. On the other hand, it also does very well with language. You encode the language in ways that this input layer of neurons and understands in terms of numbers. You don't give the word, you give an encoding of the phrase. And at the end, it gives you something interesting with respect to what is, you know, the feeling embedded in this language, or what is, as you know, that some people are doing in the field of computational psychiatry, you know, whether this person has the signatures of some particular psychosis or not. So deep learning then is one type of algorithms that sits in the world of machine learning that allows us to discover some patterns that are very, very difficult to find just by looking at it. But the deep learner has that characteristic, as we do without knowing. When I'm looking at you, my brain is doing a lot of operations of which I am not conscious, right? And the same thing is happening with the deep learning. The deep learner learns about the images, and sometimes it's very difficult for us to understand what it is doing and what patterns it is finding, but it does.
That's a very interesting point that I definitely want to go into more detail, because it sounds like one of the problems that we have with AI is that sometimes, if not always, it's a black box. And I guess it depends on the type of algorithm that you use. You know, for example, I believe with random forest, you may have some idea of what the key variables might be to making the decision, maybe through the weightings of each one that you get in the final outcome. And therefore, you could get a mechanistic idea of what's happening there. But in your experience, what do you think can solve this problem of AI being a black box? Is this solvable at all?
Yeah, this is something that some people think, don't worry about that. Why would you worry about explainability if it gives you the right accurate answer? Some people say, no, especially in precision medicine and in medicine, you want to know what is the information processing that took place in order to take a decision, because you don't want to take a decision just because a black box tells you, right? So there are ways to go into the guts of these machine learning algorithms, be it a random forest, be it support vector machine, and dig in, be it a neural network, dig into the weights, the mathematical formulas that are at the heart of these algorithms. And in the case of neural networks, it is based on the weights in which neurons in these different layers are connected to neurons and what the global computation that each of the layers seems to be doing. Maybe in some cases, the system organizes itself in such a way that the first, second, third layer do some sort of edge discovery, or this segments the figure in such a way that now only the borders of strong intensity and low intensity are highlighted. And there are many ways in which you can try to understand, but then you have to go into the algorithm, so to speak. You have to open the black box. And there is a very active field of artificial intelligence called explainable artificial intelligence that basically deals with trying to understand where is the information that these apparently intelligent algorithms are extracting, that pseudo intelligence that we see, you know, where is the prediction comes, because what did it see in the image that probably a human wouldn't have been able to see? Explainable artificial intelligence is open the black box in order to find out where was the signal.
That makes a lot of sense, and I'm sure that's a very exciting field of AI. So now if we switch gears into medicine, if you want to create new drugs in the future, it's very important to understand the pathology of the disease. You need to know, am I missing something? Is there some mechanism that I do not know about that is driving this disease? And so I think that to make successful drugs, that is very important. Maybe less so to make a diagnosis. But you and I know that one of the problems with training AI is the scarcity of quality data. It's not very abundant in medicine. Sometimes data is in silos. It's hard to get data from networks or from Medicare or Medicaid. And then to share that data between networks or collaborators is even more of a hassle. And that sometimes brings overfitting into your models. So what are your thoughts with where we are heading in with this in the future? Are we going to be able to solve those issues? Are there any initiatives that you are aware of to solve this very difficult issue that we have in medicine nowadays?
Yeah, there is a lot in that question. So let's unpack it a little bit. So the first thing is data, right? We hear a lot about this buzzword of big data, but when you look, actually, there is never enough data to feed some of the algorithms that we need to train. On the other hand, there was a second part of your question that I'm trying to...
It's not only that there is no data available, because there might not be a lot of data for a specific disease, but also that some companies or hospital networks are not sharing the data. So the data is in silos, in a sense. And as well, the electronic health record systems come from the 80s and were built by accountants who have a completely different mindset on how to lay out information compared to how you would want to look at it as a healthcare provider or as a data scientist. And then on top of that, your EHR systems don't talk well between each other. And even if people wanted to share that data, it's difficult to transfer that data across platforms. Basically, there was no standard operating procedures when everything was set up and now in 2Deep.
Right, right. And the other thing that big data, yet not so big, and the silo nature of the data world, but also you mentioned something now, I remember, the overfitting, the how do we evaluate our algorithms and so on. Yeah, no, those are incredibly important details where really the devil lives, that will make a project based on, you know, artificial intelligence to solve a medicine problem succeed or fail. If we don't have the data, we fail. If we overfit, we fail. And now we will unpack this a little bit more. So let's take one step back to deep learning. And one of the projects that was essential to show the incredible power of deep learning was a data project called ImageNet, in which the leaders of ImageNet creating a data set of millions of images, each of which was labeled with different features. There is a cat, there is a dog, there is a house, there is objects that are kind of hidden in that image, so that this process of learning by mistake or learning by example can take place. This labeling of the data sets, images in this ImageNet data program allowed people to create more and more sophisticated image analysis, deep learner algorithms that eventually were much better than humans. And that was the big surprise. This is a superhuman ability of detecting networks also at the speed, right, that we couldn't do it. How many images can you look in 1 hour? Whereas these systems could look at, you know, machine speed. So the big thing there was labeling, assembling millions of images, labeling them and using algorithms to leverage that. We wish we had this in biology and in medicine, but we don't. And the reason why we don't is a mix of different things. We have academic players, we have industry players, we have health system players, we have non-for-profit players as well. So there is an objective reality, which is that medicine data needs to be protected, right? Because it can be used in very good ways that allows doctors to help their patients, but it could be used in bad ways in which some disease that the person has can be used against them, right? So in order to protect, and because historically there was bad cases in which you clearly see that data of people can be used to hurt people, the need to protect private health information came, and then there are firewalls around data sets that contain private health information that limits, in a way, the amount of data we can share, right? But people have tried to find ways of de-identification or which is one thing, or anonymization of these data sets that would allow it to be a little bit more fair game to and safer in terms of protecting privacy to exchange between researchers. But then there is so that's a reality. It's complicated to deal with private health information. But on the other hand, there is some other reasons why people don't share data that have to do with need to have a differentiating data set that is belongs to a group that would allow this group to produce a product if it is a private industry that gives them competitive advantage, and therefore they don't want that set of data from where you can extract information that can help create their new product. They don't want to give it to their competitors, and the competitors feel the same thing, right? And finally, you have in the academic world, the competition is for scientific articles and papers, for the possibility of getting grants. And so you don't want to share too much because you are giving your competitor, which in this case is not another industry, but you know, maybe the professor next door or in the next university, that this data set will help me publish my next big paper, right? And so I will be careful not to share it, at least until I publish. And after that, I will be careful. Now, this is one way, this is a very human way of thinking, right? I protect something that can give me benefit, right? And it can be a competitive advantage. ImageNet collated millions of images. If we could collect millions of images on MRI, X-ray plates, electrocardiograms, and so on and so forth, label them and do that as a community, right? That would be fantastic. There will be an incredible progress in the sense of analyzing this data and feed the algorithms with the information they need in order to be trained. But the reality is more complex because these competitive and privacy considerations make the possibility of this happening as a reality have a lot of friction. And many groups are trying to overcome this, but you know, this is work in progress, and we will have to find a way to see the bigger picture of the need of this data in order to be able to solve this. I have been working on this for a number of years in trying to work as a community more in a collaborative fashion to democratize these data sets and make them available. There is technology that we have developed that allows us to be able to overcome some of these limitations. But before we go there, I wanted to address the other question that you mentioned, which is the overfitting problem, right? Which is related to some of the things that we were discussing, which is the following. You know that if you ask anybody, they will say that they drive better than the average, right? We cannot all drive better than the average because then the average will be above. So this notion of self-evaluation sometimes comes in the way when you evaluate the programs. These programs are not foolproof. They make mistakes, these computer algorithms. And they make mistakes that we try to quantify by some scoring metrics of performance. And sometimes when you train in your training set, which maybe is not, you don't follow best practices or it's biased and so on, you train in your data set and you look at your results, your scoring metrics of performance, you say, I'm doing great. 90% accuracy, 95% accuracy. I'm happy, I will publish and so on. And maybe you even go and publish because after all, you created this in your data set with cross-validation processes, you know, best practices in the field. But then you go with this algorithm to the data set of your colleague, which has the same characteristics and should have the same degree of performance, and it doesn't perform as well. It performs at 70% accuracy. Where did you lose that? The problem is that when you train in a relatively small data set without having into account the biases of the data set, and you don't try to look at the same algorithm in a diversity of data sets that do not have the peculiarities of your data set, One way of thinking is you memorize your data set, and therefore your performance is very well, very good. It's like you learn, you try to study for a test, you memorize this chapter. When someone asks you some question about that chapter, maybe you respond exactly the same, the right words. But you go to another chapter, you don't know anything about that chapter because there was not enough data to train you. You should have learned from a little bit from each chapter and not everything from one chapter. So this concept of almost memorizing the data, that sometimes training an algorithm in one data set that is not too big, that doesn't contain enough diversity, is called overfitting. And this is one of the things that we need to be aware when we train AI algorithms, is that our algorithm is as good as the way in which we train it. And if we train it with biased data and we make the algorithm memorize this data, then what we have done is of no value.
That's a big problem that I've certainly seen happening in the industry, and I'm sure you have as well. But one topic that I think is very interesting, and you alluded to this point, is how you were a pioneer of crowdsourcing solutions in the realm of computational biology. You actually co-founded one of the most influential and largest crowdsourcing events in computational biology, the Dream Challenge, and less succinctly put, the Dialogue for Reverse Engineering Assessments and Methods, which essentially is an international collaboration to solve fundamental questions in systems biology, similar to some other portals out there like Kaggle, for example, which is a platform where you have data sets and people trying to find solutions for these data sets, usually for prices, sometimes it's for cash or an interview at Facebook or Google or wherever. So let's go into the Dream Challenges. Why did you put this together? What have you seen come out of them? And how do you see this process working in tandem or competing with the conventional methods of coming up with solutions to problems in the world of computational biology?
At face value, the Dream Challenges looks like a competition, right? So you say, here I have a data set. For example, mammography data. Here we have a data set, you know, like we did a challenge a few years ago that was, we have like 600,000 images. Here is a problem, predict whether this woman, these mammograms, has cancer or will develop within the next year. That's a concrete problem. Here's the data, here's the problem, go try to solve it, bring it back, we will tell you whether you solved it right or well in a set of cases and mammographic exams for which we know the answer and you don't. And then let the best win. That is the face value that you can see these Dream Challenges be, but that's not the spirit at all. The spirit is that it activates the competitive juices in all of us, and people go on and work on this and they want to, but the idea is let's learn from each other. If you fail and I was a little bit better, why did you fail in this image and I didn't, and vice versa? Let's use this to collaborate in a way that otherwise we maybe would not, because I would just maybe read one of your papers, but we will never really be able to talk about one data set that we are analyzing together independently and eventually in collaboration. So that is the collaborative nature of it. But maybe in order to understand a little bit better what the Dream Challenges was about, maybe it may be useful to think of it more in terms of what the genesis was, what was the original motivation that we had when we started it, and then how it evolved to what it is today. So the original aim was based on the fact that when I was trying to reverse engineer gene expression arrays, or DNA chips, as they were called, and we discussed earlier, we wanted to learn something about the cell, what genes were interacting with which genes and with which proteins in order to give me these gene expression levels for each gene. So I wanted to imagine some sort of a proxy to the mechanism that would give rise to this data. So what is behind this data that could be really not a black box, but interactions between genes. And I could do it, and I could try to find models for that, and I could maybe do well in my own data. But was I really discovering anything? Was it the right explanation for the existing data that I have, I knew that I could fool myself. I could overfit. I knew that I could publish by cherry picking the results that I was predicting and saying, look, look, this I discovered and it was known. So what I did must have been right. But there were 1,000 other predictions that nobody would ask me about because I just presented the first 5 or 6. I knew this is not the right way to do science. So we created, with my colleague Andrea Califano, a structure that would allow us to give a group of people that want to participate in it, the crowd of crowdsourcing, data, and ask them and ask ourselves as well, would your algorithms be able to predict something that you don't know, but I do? Because if I know it and you don't, you will not be able to overfit. You will not be able to memorize because you don't know it. You know other things, you know other data sets that we give you or we link, but you don't know my data set. And then you can predict it and I can see, did you do well or not? So that was an exercise of benchmarking the algorithms in a particular data set. For example, network inference, connections between genes, as we were saying before, but also about prediction of whether a woman would survive given the genomics of her breast cancer biopsy, or whether a person that has rheumatoid arthritis will respond to anti-inflammatories, or so on and so forth, or whether a woman has breast cancer or not. So in each of these, and many more, like, you know, close to 100 challenges that we have been offering to the community, we put together a data set that sometimes we are able to cross the bridges that typically would not be crossed. But if we say this is for a challenge that is bigger than any of us, is pre-competitive, if we put together your data set, your data set, your data set, we are able to create a data set that probably will be used to either test the algorithms or train the algorithms. And that data set is given and, you know, shared with the community that learns from it and then sends their predictions about something that we have hidden or blind to them. And then we are able to benchmark, in the process of doing this, fostering collaboration, learning the limits of the algorithms given the data, determining the degree of generalizability of the algorithms and so on. So it's really not a competition, even though it could be misconstrued that, and there are aspects of a competition in it. The idea is, let's solve together a problem. Let's share the data we have. Let's use data from different sources that people might, owners of the data might be able to, might be willing to give us because this is bigger than each of us. And then we all publish together or learn together. So that is what is at the heart of the Dream Challenges, is a way to overcome some of the limitations that we have in the computational biology and artificial intelligence for medicine field, which I should, you mentioned before, are the scarcity of some types of data, the difficulties of assessing our own algorithms, and the ability to collaborate in order to learn something from the data that otherwise we wouldn't, because the data is smaller or I would be overfitting.
It sounds like it's a great initiative to solve some of these fundamental problems that we talked about earlier. And also, as you pointed out, to help cross-validate what you're doing by working and competing with different teams who will help catch your confirmation biases. So, are there any specific breakthroughs that have really stood out to you as big successes that came out of the Dream Challenges?
There were many, many interesting stories. From the participants' point of view, right, the ability to learn, if there are many, many students that start, we started this effort in 2007, and many students took place in it. And in time, they became, you know, independent researchers and professors. And I have been gratified by hearing how much these efforts have shaped the way they think in terms of applying what is basically the scientific method, right, to solve these problems in a more collaborative way and so on. that's gratifying and it's the educational part of the dream challenges. But there is also the concrete results, you know, that, for example, we run a challenge on prediction of clinical data. Now, not genomics data, but clinical data about a clinical trial for amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or ALS. One of the problems that doctors have is that if a patient presents with ALS, which is very serious disease, they could have a course of disease that is very slow. Could be, for example, Stephen Hawking. He was diagnosed with the disease when he was very young, and he died like decades later. Or another case is the case of Lou Gehrig, and this disease is called in the U.S. the Lou Gehrig's disease, because he was a famous top of his fame baseball player that was diagnosed, and in 2 years he had died. So 2 years versus decades. Can you predict, given some of the characteristics of a patient, maybe the first 3, 4, 5, 6 months of their clinical trial evolution, whether this person is going to be a long survivor or you know, a rapid progressor? That's one of the challenges that we did. And one of the participants, I think one of the ones that performed the best, had never even heard of the word ALS, right, of the term ALS. But they did very well. They had the right ideas. And they found that they could predict with enough precision that they could reduce the number of, you know, when you organize a clinical trial, you need to power it with enough people so that it can answer your question to the degree that you want, right? So they noticed that with the degree of prediction that they solved the problem that we had given in the Dream Challenge, they were able to reduce by 10% a phase 3 clinical trial, which means a lot of savings for the company that is organizing it. And so they put up a company. So the challenge triggered their entrepreneurship, and then they moved on, created a company that I think is still going on out there. And a final example is something that, like I said before, is this challenge in which we gave data for mammographic exams for women. That data was private. We could never share it, but we put it behind the firewall. It was offered to us generously by Kaiser Permanente Washington, and we put it inside the firewall so that participants in the challenge could never see it. And they would send their code in a paradigm that we call model to data. The models would be trained in their own data or in existing public data sets, but they would be further trained inside the firewall and then tested for how well they generalize to other data sets inside the firewall, and then the scores will be known. And we wanted to show whether or not algorithmically, we can predict better than the radiologist would. That means that this scoring metric that assesses the performance of the radiologist or the algorithm would be comparable. And we found that no algorithm could do better than the radiologist. It was in the same time in which others were saying that they could. And so we believe that we were doing the right way because we were kind of completely separating the development from the testing, right? And in this way, the assessment was more objective. But then what we did was putting together all the algorithms into what we call an ensemble of algorithms and leverage the strengths of different algorithms for some images, even when some other algorithms maybe would do poorly. So that ensemble did much better than the best of the algorithms, but still not better than the radiologists. So we thought, why don't we put together the assessment of the radiologists independently of the assessment of the ensemble of algorithms? And that, yes, was much better than the, significantly than the radiologist assessment that individually was the best. But you put them together in a smart way, the resulting rate of error was lower, enough to reduce the false positive rate in such a way that would help like 500,000 women not be in a situation in which they are told, you have to come back because we saw something in your mammogram that requires more diagnostic testing rather than screening. And then people are scared when they are recalled, only to be to know that they are okay, right? So, but what if you can do that? You don't recall them directly. That's better, right? And the improvement meant that 500,000 women would not be recalled in the U.S., and that would be a huge savings also in terms of extra for the health system. Huge savings in terms of extra diagnostic tests and so on. So the nice thing about this paper, because we were trying to extract lessons, is that it is the ensemble of different parts, the wisdom of the crowds, as I like to call it, because in a way it's not, it's the algorithm, the many of them, the radiologist that has a different way of thinking or looking at the images than the deep learners, constitute a little crowd that if you can articulate what is good from one side or what is good from the other side, you do better than all. So it shows the need to think outside of the box when it comes to how do we garner all this diversity of algorithms, and rather than say, this is the best, this is mine, this is the best, I will use this, is say, this may be very good, but there are others that are a little bit complementary to me. You know, let's put them together in an ensemble. Even though it's not mine, we gain from it. And we think in terms of also leveraging the medical wisdom in a way that combines with artificial intelligence. And then we have the better world of all the worlds, right?
Absolutely. That's very interesting. Not only how you combined the different algorithms into an ensemble, but also put the radiologist together with the AI, kind of like summing all of those intelligence or wisdoms, which led to a better overall result. And so that ties into one of the questions that a lot of people ask themselves, which is, are AI algorithms eventually going to take over the role of the doctor? And I'm not sure what you think of that, but it sounds like at the very least, there should be a synergy between the two in the future.
Totally. That is probably the most important message of that piece of work, that collaboration, which was, it's not replacing, but it's enhancing, right? It's enhancing the cognitive capabilities of our doctors with extra elements that can maybe process information more rapidly or get to understand patterns that maybe our brains are unable to do. So you don't want to replace, because what the radiologists are bringing is super important, right? But let's not forget that there are other ways to analyze the data that could be also very valuable.
And one of the ideas that you mentioned was that some of these teams actually launch companies coming out of the Dream Challenges, leveraging their expertise. And somewhat similarly, you recently made a big move from academia and IBM to being the chief scientific officer at Semaphore, an AI and data-driven precision medicine company. So could you tell us a bit more about the scope of the company and what's really at the core driving the whole operation?
Sure. Yeah, Semaphore is one good example of a company that is trying to leverage all the size of the ecosystem of the healthcare industry needed in order to put together the elements that we need in order to create precision medicine, make precision medicine a reality. And what do I mean by that? Let's go back a little bit to our earlier discussion that we were saying, you know, the ImageNet was necessary in order to create the data sets that are needed in order to train the algorithms that eventually would be superhuman in their performance. But someone has to put together the data sets, and someone has to do the AI, and someone has to do the evaluation, right? So what are the parts of the ecosystem that Semaphore has put together and that differentiates Semaphore in its business model? On the one hand, you have the physicality of the medicine, the tests, the diagnostic tests or the therapy prediction tests based on the data, the genomics, the genetics, the proteomics, and so on. You start by getting the data from the people. We have that. Then you have to have health systems that work with you in order to see what the doctors really need in order to help their patients best. You need to be in contact with the doctors. You need to be understanding the needs of the patients. And if you are separate from it, if you don't talk with those health systems, you are missing a big part, a fundamental part of what the ecosystem is. Good. So we have at this point for health systems that our partners, and we are growing that base, we need them in order to understand the practice of the medicine that we are trying to create. And they need us because we provide the third piece, which is the artificial intelligence applications that takes the data that we just generated, takes the electronic health records that contain the information of all the health history of the patients that are also essential in order to put A and B, or 1+1, genomics and electronic health records and real world evidence. And that 1+1 is more than 2. They inform each other in ways that otherwise you couldn't. So the artificial intelligence is all what we are trying to do in the company, in the context then of all this data generation and health system partners. Put together that data, we come and analyze this data in ways that are, I would say, very interesting, using network models of biology, using artificial intelligence, deep learning, natural language processing. One of the things that we hope we can do, we are working very hard to do it, is what you can learn from this data will bring you to new ways of analyzing or finding or discovering biomarkers of specific subtypes of disease that will allow you to be more precise in delivering medicine to those patients that have these particular biomarkers that we hope we will discover, and we are working on discovering by analyzing all this data. And so once we have these biomarkers that could be not just genetics or genomics or proteomics, but also you can find them in the electronic health records, you can make predictions as to what is the best course of treatment for this individual. So that process of innovation is what I am very passionate about. It's like getting all the pieces of this ecosystem, putting them into a very well-formulated question, discover a new test, if you will, that will allow us to address some medical problems more precisely. And that is what precision medicine is. At the same time, and let me give you an example that is a paper that was recently published from Semaphore, which is, and I wasn't involved in it, but one of our researchers was, the prediction of postpartum hemorrhage. That is a very serious condition that could be terrible for the mom giving birth. And you need to predict that based on some indications and early signals that you can find from the electronic health records and the pregnancy journey of the woman. And if you detect that there may be a problem, then you have to be prepared in the room where the baby is delivered so that if that happens, you are rapid to help them. So that is one example of algorithms that we are doing. But also we are working in discovering targets for potential drugs in subtypes of diseases that will target by using network models that find for a specific patient vulnerable proteins that if you inhibit, for example, will kill the cancer or will decrease the ability of that cancer to proliferate, because you have found in this particular patient, by analyzing the network of interactions of its molecular entities, which is the most vulnerable, so that when you suppress it, the cancer doesn't have that proliferative power that it had that target not be inhibited. So, and we are looking at many aspects of disease in oncology, in women and reproductive health, in population health. We will create a number of algorithms that will also think in terms of benchmarking. As we said before, right, benchmark these algorithms, because by themselves, we might fool ourselves that they are the best, but we need to test them in platforms like what we said before, like the Dream Challenge, is to benchmark with the best and use for the patients the best algorithms, not necessarily ours. If there are no others, we will use others. If there are others, we will compare head to head. And then we create this platform of algorithms that will allow us to serve the patients that our health partner health systems and any other patient could be best served with all the artificial intelligence well benchmarked and with the best algorithms in its class.
I know that there is a lot of competition right now in the space, and you guys are a public company, and there are lots of players. You know, for example, Google has a very active branch in AI and healthcare, and there are some other big guys in the field. So without getting into too much detail, how can you actually protect and enforce your intellectual property and patents? I know it's difficult since you want to publish your paper and share your results, but you also don't want to show your cards too early. So you can tell us maybe broadly if there are ways to enforce your patents and make sure that you keep your competitive advantage in any way?
Yes, we firmly believe, and this is part of my, you know, evolution with the Dream Challenges, that there is a need to be open when we practice science. So we are all for publication of our results. We are all for, you know, divulgation of the things that we are discovering. But at the same time, we don't want to be stopped by others from doing the medicine that we know we can do. And so one of the strategies that can be used in this context is defensive patenting. It's not that you are creating patents in order to go and stop the operation of others. Simply create your intellectual property in such a way that you can have freedom to operate and to do the things that you know, intellectual pursuit brought you to do that is good for the patients. I don't want to stop doing it. So that kind of defensive patenting is part of our strategy.
Well, that's a very interesting way to go about it. So let's wrap up here with one more question. Your path to precision medicine was a very interesting one, an amazing one. You completed both your undergrad and graduate degrees in physics in Buenos Aires and Yale, respectively, and your PhD is specifically in turbulence, which is a bit far off precision medicine. And a lot of our listeners might be at a point in their careers where they are considering a path into computational biology with the aim to work in precision medicine. So, in your opinion, what is the best route to break into the field? Would it be medicine and then AI, the other way around, or some other combination? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I think for the younger generation listening in is follow your heart, right? So what you think is good, but you know, don't limit yourself to do only what is expected. Follow your heart, follow your dreams. What is the right path? You know, it's very hard to say. I would say my path, it was kind of a sequence of bifurcations that I took the opportunity to do these things because they presented themselves to me. And at that point, it seemed a reasonable thing to do. But there were some junctures in my career in which I asked myself the following question that could help elucidate what is the career path to follow, which is, what are the important questions today? What are the questions that, from the perspective of a scientific career driven by intellectual curiosity, or from the perspective of the applications of this to a world that is evolving rapidly and that needs new technology, there are business opportunities that would be fed by investment that you need in order to do what you want if you have a technology and scientific mind? What are the right questions to ask? Science, technology, business, that will, and forgive me for this grandiloquence, will change the world. And you have to think that way. It doesn't mean that you will, but it means, are there big questions? Or I'm going to work on the detail of something that will make an incremental advancement to a field, but is not going to move the needle. So I find that at different points of my career, when I had to take a decision, I asked myself that question, right? Is this going to move the needle? and try if you have some difficulty in understanding, really, because it's so hard to predict, you know, the path that one will follow. But when you are at the bifurcation point, think which one is the direction that I should go that really will move the needle, and be bold. And, you know, I would say to that younger generation, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. It's better to regret that you took a decision that it was bold, and I have taken many paths to failure. It's better to fail than never to risk it. Because when you take a risk that could have big gains, scientifically, business-wise, technological-wise, then you are in the game. But if you never take a risk, you are at best a smart spectator. And so I prefer to be an active protagonist, even at the risk of failure.
Well, that was an amazing advice. Not only does it have wisdom for our career choices, but also can translate to many other aspects of life. So with that, thank you, Gustavo. It was an absolute pleasure having you on to chat today about the world of precision medicine and to hear more about your perspectives on the past, the present, and the future directions of this massively impactful field of medicine. So thank you again for taking the time today, and we look forward to catching up in the future.
Armando, it was an absolute pleasure to chat with you, and thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Life Sciences Revolution podcast. I hope you enjoyed, and if you did, please consider rating us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And now, here is In Motion by Jank Setup to close us out.